welcome to episode 192 of the Cricket Her Weekly. We've got a few stories that we're going to get our teeth into in this week's episode, so let's dive right in, Sid. The first thing that we're going to be talking about relates to the 100, because there's been an interesting article by Will McPherson in The Telegraph this week, all about the 100, a little bit of a scoop there by Will. And he's given a few pieces of information. Now, there's obviously been a lot of conversations about the future of the 100, what it might look like, whether it's actually going to continue at all. So we are now getting a little bit more information potentially about what the future of the 100 is going to look like, because it sounds like it is going to stay as the 100, but it's going to probably expand to 10 teams, which is interesting. That's interesting for a reason that relates to the first class counties, isn't it, Sid, in terms of actually bringing in more of the first class counties on board, because we've got 18 men's first class counties, haven't we? So if you bump up the number of 100 teams to 10, what does that do to the maths?
It suddenly means that there's a majority of teams have 100 teams.
Yeah.
And then a majority of teams have some sort of potential buy-in to creating a situation for the men's first class game where they go, look, let's just reduce the first class aspect of the game, the sort of Div 1, to just 10 teams, and then, you know, we'll, the other teams can become sort of semi-professional,
yeah,
and
we'll
leave them out of everything. So it's another potential step on this road, and I think a lot of people in the men's game are being naive about this. It's another potential step to putting the ECB in a situation where they can realistically do this manoeuvre where they reduce the number of first-class men's counties to just the big teams. And obviously, there was definitely a hope for a while that they'd be able to get only 8 teams out of it. They obviously concluded that's not going to work, but 10 teams suddenly gives you the vote.
You've got the maths, haven't you? Yeah, you've got the majority vote then. So that's interesting.
And that obviously has implications for the women's game.
Yes,
because,
it does.
You know, the women's game is likely to follow in this regard, right? So, you know, if we can say that there are only 10 first-class counties, that creates a situation where you've got 10... potentially 10 women's teams. And the women's teams are definitely an issue here, because, you know, there's definitely worries. Will mentions this in the article about whether, you know, we can sustain 10 women's teams at the moment.
Yeah.
Obviously, it does mean, again, at the moment, the ECB are paying for the women's teams. So if you increase it to 10 women's teams, then, you know, you have to pay for those teams. And that means that the money's going to be potentially spread thinner for everyone else. So a few questions around that.
But Sid, if you push the women's regions back to being the responsibility of the men's counties, then the ECB doesn't have to pay.
And potentially the ECB doesn't have to pay for it. Yeah, potentially.
So
force those counties to do that. And that's definitely, you know, potentially part of the medium-term plan. There have been whispers about, you know, what's going on at the moment and, you know, whether we will see the women's, what we call the women's regions, kind of folded back into the men's system.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? Of course, the other thing is that's very frustrating about this that we have talked about before is that we're talking about votes here, and we're talking about the men's first class counties voting on this and having majority say in it, and that at the moment means that there's absolutely no representation of women's cricket in these huge decisions that have massive ramifications for the future of women's cricket. Very frustrating.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at the moment, as we say, the women's regions kind of exist in their own sphere. They've got no kind of legal, I mean, they're legally their businesses, but they've got kind of no part in the legal voting structure and the government structure.
And the ISEC commission very heavily criticised that.
Yeah, so this needs to change. One way of potentially changing that is to kind of, from the ECB's perspective, is to fold the regions back into the men's counties and go, well, there's your representation, it's the men's counties. And of course, then we're back in a situation where the men's counties, you know, whose priority, not unreasonably, is men's county cricket, are, you know, the only representation of the women's game. And, you know, we know where that leads because we've already been there 20 years ago.
Absolutely. They did absolutely nothing to promote or develop women's county cricket, so that's a concern. The other worrying aspect of this article by Will McPherson was actually about private investment into the 100 from abroad, we're talking about, aren't we, really? And there's a bit of the article that's quite interesting where it says it's felt by insiders that this kind of large sums of money coming in from private investment from other countries will allow teams to pay the players more, which will attract the world's best players and improve the product. So one of the criticisms of the men's 100 has been that it's basically like a second or third class franchise competition because the best players aren't coming because the salaries aren't high enough. We think that that's absolutely laughable because really, given that the women's 100 is paying so much less than the men's 100 and yet our product is so much better than the men's one at the moment. But this is something that is commonly talked about in regard to the men's 100. So now, Sid, I know you're a bit sceptical about this idea that we get in investment and we can do whatever we like with it within English cricket, right?
Yeah, I mean, okay, there's a lot of problems with this, and some of them we've talked about before. I mean, one of the problems for me is like who this investment comes from. You know, it's interesting that this investment, they've acknowledged this investment is coming from overseas, because nobody in this country is going to be stupid enough to invest in this, because you're not investing anything, basically. It's an invitation to give us money.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, if people are giving money away, you know, please give me some. But
yeah, but that would be lovely. Thanks.
So what they're looking to do is to get investment from, you know, from billionaires in India, from billionaires in the Middle East. I'm uncomfortable with investment coming from those places. But, you know, let's look past that for a moment and look at what people are proposing to do with this investment. Because I think this is absolutely bonkers what's being said here. What they're proposing to do with the investment is pay the players. And, of course, pay the players lots of money means try and create a better league by playing the men lots of money.
Yeah.
So, you know, first of all, that ultimately the ambition here of the ECB or the 100, you know, it can't be to be the best kind of franchise competition in the world. That's just not open anymore. The best franchise competition in the world is the IPL.
Yeah.
And because none of the Indian players are ever going to be allowed to ever play other franchise competitions now, because that's been laid down, the BCCI aren't going to change that.
Yeah.
You are never going to be the best franchise competition in the world. The best you can hope for is to be the second best.
Mm-hmm.
You know, okay, so you take a load of investment and you spend that all on paying your male players for 2 or 3 years, and then what? You've taken this investment, you've spent it on paying salaries for your top male players, and then
what's happened?
You've got no money. Not only have you got no money, but you know, the investors, they're not going to invest for nothing, right?
Yeah.
You know, if you've, you know, watched a show like Dragon's Den, for example, you know that when investors invest, they want something in return.
Absolutely.
They want either equity or a share of your future revenues or power. So, you know, if you're advocating taking this investment money from overseas billionaires and spending it on the salaries of your male cricketers, you're one of three things. Either you're stupid, which I don't think these people are. Secondly, you're thinking, I can hoodwink these overseas billionaires. I can take their money and I can just spend it on the male players and creating a really good league. And then after 3 years, then we'll just say, oh, sorry, guys, can we have some more money now, please? Because we spent all that money and... And realistically, that's not going to happen. You know, Indian billionaires did not get to be Indian billionaires by being stupid enough to make that kind of investment. They're only going to invest if they get a substantial share of future revenues or if it gives them power. Now, you know, so for instance, the reason they've invested in the overseas leagues in South Africa, in the West Indies and in the United States is because they think that's giving them power in the future, right? They're not looking for money there, they're looking for power. In this case, they're probably more likely to look for money, I would have thought. They want a share of those future revenues. And where are the future revenues going to come from if in 3 years' time you've got no money left to pay any of the players?
Yeah.
Are the top players, apart from the Indians, of course, where aren't going to come anyway, are the top players going to come for that? No, of course they're not. So, you know, you're not going to hoodwink those overseas investors. That's just bonkers.
Okay.
The third possibility is actually even worse, that what you're doing is you are deliberately going, look, I know this is bonkers, but if they're going to give me loads of money, I'm going to pay the top players loads of money. And then, of course, I myself, as the manager of the, you know, the London, whatever they are, the London Superchargers, if I'm paying players, you know, £1 million to play in this comp, obviously I need a salary of £1 million as well. They're looting cricket's present.
And people, as we've seen, can then disappear.
I paid myself £5 million a year for the 3 years that I was, you know, the chief executive of the King's 11 London. And then I went off and now it's all gone bankrupt and all gone to hell.
Not naming any names, but that's certainly something that we have seen recently within English cricket.
So,
Not naming any names because I don't want any lawyers coming after me.
One thing that's really interesting is that there was an interview with the current Surrey chief executive, who I'm really sorry, I've forgotten his name. So apologies for that. But what he said was, he pointed out that actually this was bonkers. He said, you can't use this investment money to pay players. And he pointed out, this is what's happened in Premiership rugby in this country, that they use a load of investment money to pay the players loads of money and to give the players the salaries the players thought they deserved, which were like salaries, something close, you know, perhaps closer to, you know, what cricketers and, you know, some footballers they perceive were being, although I think they were still being paid a lot less than footballers. Anyway, it's resulted in a load of Premiership and top rugby clubs going bust because they now can no longer afford to pay the players that money. They've committed to paying players, you know, £200,000 or £300,000 a year for their entire squad, but they've spent all the investment money. No one's given them any more investment money, and now they're in trouble. And that's exactly what's going to happen in cricket. Surrey, interestingly enough, said they won't do that. They'll said they will, if they have investment money, they'll use it for investment, and then they will keep the future revenue for themselves. Okay. That's the way you need to run it, but it really looks like everyone else is going, ha-ha, here's an opportunity for us to pay ourselves loads of money right now. And
the problem is you set future expectations then, don't you? And I think I've talked about this before on the podcast, that actually one of the issues is that the ECB isn't even prepared to say to its own England men's players, sorry, but you've got to play in the 100, it's a contractual obligation. And if you don't, then you won't be playing for England. And they're not actually prepared to be that blunt about it, because they think that, I don't know, that these players will then just disappear and won't play for England anymore. And I'm just like, well, to some extent, good riddance then. If you value the money that you can get from going off and playing elsewhere over representing England, then that's fine. We've got, you know, 100 players who would happily replace you. And I don't think that it's the I don't think that's actually what would happen ultimately. But the ECB aren't prepared to be that bold about it. And that's where you're going wrong. So if you're not even prepared to do that, how can you possibly expect to attract players from overseas? The other thing is, of course, that actually what's meant to be happening right now is that the ECB are meant to have a commitment to equalising salaries in the 100 between the men and the women, because that's one of the ISEC Commission recommendations. So we're not hearing anything about that. We're hearing
we're talking about
foreign investment
to try and increase the pay of the male players even more.
And nobody is actually going, hang on a minute, that's completely contrary to everything that you've committed to in terms of fulfilling the requirements of the commission. So
yeah, I think it's going in a very disappointing direction. And you know, I do fear that it'll end up like, you know, in the way that we're going, and that, you know, people are going to take this investment, they're going to spend it, and in, you know, 8, 9, 10 years time, we're going to see, you know, these franchises going bust, or wholly owned effectively by people that are, you know, involved in the BCCI.
Yeah. Anyway, talking of the women's regions, or whatever they may become, we do now have a fixture list for next year, next summer, which again, the ECB have, credit to them, the last couple of years, actually, we have had the fixtures a lot earlier than we would have had them previously, when they might have been announced, I don't know, three weeks before the season was due to start. So we know the format and the kind of shape of the domestic calendar now for next season. So the Rachel Hayhoe Flint Trophy is going to begin the season, so the 50 over competition, that's going to start in April and May, then have a bit of a break, and then resume at the end of June, then have another break for the 100 and resume kind of the end of August, and there'll be a final at Leicester at the end of September. So a similar structure to the one that we had last summer, or last English season. The Lottie Cup is again going to be played in May and June, as in that kind of first break of the Rachel Hayhoe Flint Trophy. But there are a few changes to the Lottie Cup. So that's being expanded, so that each team is now playing 10 group stage matches instead of 7. And the finals day is going to be at Derby. Boo. Sorry, Derby. Anyway, it's going to be at Derby, but they are introducing semi-finals. So we're reverting back to a similar finals day to the one that we used to have in the Kia Super League, whereby you have two semi-finals on the same day and then a final.
No, we never had that in the Super League.
Didn't we?
No, it was the Kia Super League was where the one semi-final started.
Ah, okay.
And you're misremembering.
Sorry, I am misremembering.
Back in the Women's County Championship.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Okay, back in the Women's County Championship days, when we used to have those, triple header days, and they were really long and endless. So we're going back to that. Yeah. Gosh, we are. We're going back even further.
Well, it's basically
like
the men's T20 blast. So, yeah. I mean, you know, for me, there's still one thing that's missing here, you know, that which the men's T20 blast has, which the women's competition, as far as I can see, isn't going to have, and that's a mascot race. So until we have a mascots race on T20 finals day, we don't have true equality. So,
okay,
Beth Barrett Wild, over to you.
Sorry, I don't know where I got that from. Of course, the KSL, we only had one semi-final. Anyway, yeah, so I don't really like these very long triple-header days, but I suppose it kind of makes sense from a sort of commercial perspective to have them all on that one day. And of course, we had said that it was very likely we felt that it was going to move towards having these two semi-finals, right?
Yeah, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. You know, it does make for a very long day for everybody involved. You know, but it's a big day. It's a fun day. Hopefully, you get a few more fans there because you've got fans of four teams going up rather than three teams. So that's all positive. You know, and the number of games overall is being expanded, as we said.
Yeah.
It's not being expanded to a full home and away program, which is there's going to be a regional element to it. So there's going to be a home and away. You're going to play everybody either home or away.
Yeah.
And then you're kind of some local groups look to have been established, as far as I can see, in effect, whereby Vipers are playing Stars, Storm and Sunrisers, for example, the kind of the extra time. So they're going to play 10 games in the season. Three cheers for playing more games, but rather less cheers for it now being an unbalanced competition, because it means that, you know, whoever turn out to be next year's wooden spoon candidates, I fear it's probably going to be Storm. Sorry, guys.
Let's see. You know.
So, well, I guess that's good for Vipers because they get to play Storm twice, but somebody else doesn't get to play Storm twice and they have potentially a harder time with their extra games.
Yeah.
So I don't really like it from a competitive perspective.
You have,
but
you've talked about
on
that
on the other
before.
Hand, there are more games.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
So what are your thoughts on the whole thing, Raph?
Well, a couple of things. One of the things that's really bugged me is that I've just praised the ECB for announcing the fixtures list. And obviously the reason for announcing it this far in advance is so that people can make plans. But if you announce a fixture list and half of the fixtures don't have a location, that's not really very useful for people to plan ahead. So I actually went through and counted. And for the Rachel Hay O'Flynn Trophy, so for the 50 overs, 12 of the group stage matches have their venues still as TBC. It's not just a couple, it's not just a few here and there, it's actually 12, which is a substantial proportion of the group stage matches. So I don't think that's good enough, actually. And I guess what's going on here is that, obviously, as always happens, women's cricket is having to negotiate with the men who own the grounds and say, oh, please, can we slot in to your ground? And the men are going, oh, no, we might actually be using it for something else more important. So frustrating, so rude. And we've talked about the issues that we had last season with some of the grounds not being very good. Well back. and, you know, there being issues with, so for example, that strange Sparks v Vipers match that was played at Wormsley in Buckinghamshire, which just didn't seem to make sense. So in a way, you can't even make plans to go, oh, well, I know it will be a home match or an away match, because it might end up being played in a different region. So who even knows? So that's one of the frustrating things. The other thing that I can't quite understand why, well, I suppose I can understand why, but it's the expansion of the double headers. So we've gone from having 20 double headers last season between the Blast and the Lossie Cup to 22 this next season, in the 2024 season. So I just think, well, okay, obviously somebody has decided that this is a good idea. I guess it cuts down on the logistics because it's just the same day. But I don't know that they're necessarily doing anything very good for women's domestic cricket at the moment. I feel frustrated with this idea that somehow, well, double headers are good in the 100, so they're good everywhere. Well, they don't work very well in this kind of blast situation because the teams aren't the same.
Fans aren't turning up. Bit of an effort. There are obviously some of the games where they've aligned them where you've
not
got
perfectly though.
Essex, well, you've got both teams aligned basically, so you've got Essex and Sunrisers playing, is it Western Storm and Somerset, I think, in one case. So there's a little bit of alignment, but there's also a lot of non-alignment where the travelling fans are going to be, you know, different.
Absolutely, and also, you know, one of the benefits potentially is meant to be, well, you get some of these women's T20 domestic matches on TV. I don't really recall that happening particularly last season. I think a lot of the time you were getting the same commentators who do the women's commentary on the women's regional stuff were turning up and doing their commentary at one end of the ground, and it was going out on the live stream of YouTube, and then the men's game was going out on Sky. As a proper televised match. So there's not really any benefit there that I can see. I just get frustrated with double headers, feel like they devalue what we're trying to do to some extent in women's cricket. And I understand them in the 100, and I've accepted them in the 100, and I've actually embraced them in the 100 because they work. I don't think they're working.
They work in the 100 because they're the same teams, whereas, you know, especially when you don't even have the aligned teams both playing at the same time.
So that's a bit frustrating. Obviously, the other thing, Sid, about this, the men's fixtures were announced at the same time. Middlesex men are playing three of their home matches at Chelmsford in Essex. What on earth is going on there?
Yeah, apparently hasn't gone down too well with the fans and the members at Middlesex. But I mean, my worry here is just very quickly, it's a little one, but I mean, you know, Middlesex as a kind of men's county are obviously in a deal of trouble. Yeah, and they're supposed to be responsible. They're the lead county for their women's franchise, for Sunrisers. That's got to be a worry for the women's game, because, you know, if the men's game, the men's club are in financial trouble, which they clearly are, even though they're trying to kind of play it down and go, oh, we just want to spread the love.
spread the love to Essex.
So, you know, that's just got to be one to keep an eye on, because if the men's county are in trouble, that spells problems potentially for the women's franchise.
Absolutely. Okay, and finally this week, we have had a further announcement in relation to the England A team. We'd obviously had a full squad that was announced that had gone out to Oman to play some kind of acclimatisation matches. And then some of those players have been selected who are now going to fly to India and play those matches against India A. So it's sort of been narrowed down a little bit. So it's an interesting looking squad, actually. Sid, I know you've got thoughts about some of the elements of it. So, for example, four of the players in the A squad, as far as we can work out, are going to be ones who are, well, we know that they're staying on for the main squad.
Yeah, the main
and we
squads
think
are
they're likely to play, right? So that's Charlie Dean, Mahika Gore, Lauren Filer and Freya Kemp. And so do we think that those four players then are likely to then be playing in those A matches?
Yeah, I mean, you'd imagine that they're going to play in all those A matches. And, you know, it just feels like the wrong use of the opportunity of the A tour to use that to just basically get some additional match practice for players that are, you know, perhaps slightly more fringe players from your main team. You know, that doesn't feel like the right thing to have done there. So I'm disappointed, because some of the players that they've flown home now are players some of the players like Kelly and Moore that I think actually should have gone and had this opportunity to really build for the future. Because that's what this A thing really needs to be about. It needs to be about building for the future. There's also the issue of the captaincy.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, they've decided not to make Grace Scrivens captain. They've made Charlie Dean captain. I'm a little bit disappointed with that. I think that they should have used the opportunity to kind of give Grace Scrivens more experience here.
But isn't this an interesting move, because is this an indication that Charlie Dean's the future England captain?
Yeah, well, Charlie Dean, I mean, you know, Charlie Dean, I think there's a good chance that Charlie Dean does captain England one day.
Yeah.
But as a one-off, as a, you know, when the actual captain is, you know, unable to play or is injured or is resting, I think there's a good chance that Charlie Dean at some point steps up and, you know, gets her name added to that list. And, you know, why not? But Charlie Dean is never going to be the permanent England captain. I like Charlie Dean a lot,
okay,
but she's never going to be.
Why?
The permanent, because Sophie Eccleston exists, Raph.
Okay. What?
Okay, the key issue is for Charlie Dean in terms of the England captaincy is Sophie Eccleston exists. Sophie Eccleston is the best bowler in the world.
Yeah.
There's no evidence that she's going to be anything other than the best bowler in the world, or at least one of the best bowlers in the world for most of the next sort of 8-10 years for the rest of her career, because she's been up there, you know, she's been remarkably consistent. She's going to stay there.
Yeah.
If you have Sophie Eccleston, therefore, as an absolutely nailed-on, guaranteed pick for every single game, and you then make another spinner a nailed on pick by making her captain, it means you've totally closed down your spin options.
That's
it
true.
Means, for instance, that Sarah Glenn's England career is essentially over. Because the number of times that England are going to play three specialist spinners is going to be pretty low.
Okay.
I can't see England closing down. They don't like making bowlers captain anyway. They'd much rather batters were captain, but they're not going to make a spinner captain because it just closes down their options too
much. I'd like to make a point in Charlie Dean's defence then, which is that she is a batter. She is also a bowler. She's an all-rounder. And actually the unfortunate thing for her has been that England have viewed her too predominantly as an off-spinner rather than the batter that she actually is and has shown herself to be in domestic cricket. And that's what's made her path to the captaincy difficult. So England need to reevaluate what they see her bringing to the team, I would say.
Okay.
But yeah, it does feel a little bit like this is Heather Knight defending her own position again. She doesn't want to name Grace Scribbins as the next captain because that's too much of a threat, potentially.
Yeah, and you know, at the end of the day, Heather Knight has learnt well from the fact that she kind of became a threat to Charlotte Edwards herself when she became the vice captain all those years ago. So, but let's see also what they do with this tour. There's also another A tour this winter to New Zealand. Let's see what they do there, and let's see if they make Grace captain for that one. But you know, I do understand the captaincy thing. I also wonder if potentially ADR was actually supposed to be the captain for this, but ADR, we're told, has come back to England due to a family bereavement. That's not a secret. That was in the press release.
Yeah.
So you know, love and thoughts with her.
Absolutely.
But I wonder if she was actually originally intended to be the captain for that.
Quite
that
possibly.
A team, which would perhaps have made a little bit more sense
again,
because she's someone that's
It makes sense for Heather Knight because she's no threat to her.
Well, I mean, she's The other thing about the A squad, slightly more generally, is again that there's probably I'm not going to name them because it feels unfair. But there are four. Look through the names. There are four players in there that I'm fairly confident will never play for England in the future.
It's tipping towards this is a kind of token gesture because we wanted to give our main players who haven't been in WBBL a bit of warm-up, proper match warm-up in India, rather than this is a genuine developmental opportunity.
Yeah, and you have to say, you shouldn't be picking for the A team, you shouldn't be picking the second best 11 players. In other words, players, whatever it is, you know, the players 15 to 26 or whatever it is. You're not picking a second team. What you're doing is trying to pick a future team, and they haven't done that. If you're including four players who will never play for England in the future, two of whom have played in the past.
Yeah, I mean, and we've just had an under-19s World Cup, so we know who the players are that they've got their eye on for the future.
Yeah,
because
so
they played in the under-19s World Cup, and there's very few of those now. I haven't actually been through and checked the list, but probably can't be more than a couple.
Yeah.
Anyway, right, gosh, we've gone on today, Sid. Thank you for your patience. We hope you've enjoyed this week's episode.
Thanks for watching.
Bye for now.
Bye.